It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Wisconsin has a national treasure right in our backyard, the Ice Age National Scenic Trail. We'll talk to an outdoor writer about how to enjoy it, even in winter.
First, as people around the country settle into holiday mode, presidential campaigns are gearing up and strategizing for the most important month of the campaign so far. When we come back from winter break, we'll have less than a month before the Iowa caucuses.
And that's when, despite the countless polls, we will actually see how primary voters feel about the candidates. It's time for our weekly look at the latest in national politics with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.
This week, Donald Trump took a swing at Hillary Clinton, Lindsey Graham dropped out of the race, and a budget showdown has been avoided for yet another year. Harry, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
So Donald Trump has been tangling with just about everybody. He's been egalitarian in that, and this time it was Hillary Clinton. There was an off-color remark there, some interpreted as that he directed at her, and she has opted not to respond. How come?
I think that this is just a very wise strategy because Donald Trump loves media attention. You know, we ran a study here which basically tried to predict how high the different candidates would be in the polls based upon their favorable ratings and their media coverage. And it turns out that Trump is as high as he is despite not in the Republican race, despite not having great favorable ratings, because he receives so much media attention. And Trump makes these remarks, I think, in large part because he knows that the media is going to go cover them. And Clinton has decided, you know what, I'm not going to give you the time of day on this. I'm not going to, say, give you this media coverage. So I'm just not going to respond to it. And it has, in my opinion, is a fairly smart strategy.
Yeah, but it didn't really work out well for, say, Jeb Bush, who endured all the slings and arrows that Trump shot his way, didn't really say anything. And then Trump sort of said, look at this guy, he's low energy. And then that became the running narrative.
Well, I would say that he tried to respond to those. Unfortunately for Jeb Bush, he didn't do a very good job of responding. You know, he tried to go on the attack against Trump, and then Trump would kind of shut him down, and Bush just didn't have the energy. I guess he was, quote-unquote, very low energy to fight back, versus someone like Ted Cruz, who Trump had gone after, and Cruz basically said, nah, we're buddy-buddy. And Trump kind of looked around and said, what the heck am I supposed to do with that? And that's, I think, part of the reason right now that Ted Cruz is very competitive with Trump in Iowa, in fact, leading Trump in Iowa, and decently competitive with him in New Hampshire. And those are the states that we're watching here at 538, not so much the national polling.
Well, Clinton had said that she would be more direct in calling out sexism during this campaign compared with her 2008 campaign. How come, you know, she's not making good on that with this?
I think, you know, Trump is a different case of from everything else, right? When you hear, when the Clinton campaign has heard some sexist remarks or what were deemed by them to be at least somewhat sexist remarks from people who were supporting Bernie Sanders, they went ahead and called those out. But I think Trump is so unique in that Trump just doesn't care. He's not PC. He doesn't care if he makes a remark that people don't necessarily like. He recognizes the way that he stays atop the polls is by having a lot of media cover him. And so Clinton, in my opinion, is being very smart in saying, I am not going to dignify what Trump has said about, you know, whatever it was that he was talking about, in which he referenced her. And she will only go after him when there are policy differences. And I think that's something key, right? What she wants to do is say, here, the Republicans are really extreme, and Trump may be an illustration of that, but we'll talk about his policies and not so much his personal remarks.
And we're going to move on from Donald Trump, but this does lead into a bigger discussion about polling. And Donald Trump is still on top and maybe even in some cases gaining ground. And we know the polls at this point are not necessarily predictive of what's going to happen in the primary. But what do the current polls tell us about Donald Trump?
Well, I think that this is a very interesting situation insofar as that Donald Trump is clearly doing very well in these national primary polls. So CNN had a poll out today, and he was at his highest point ever in the CNN poll in the high 30s. There have been some polls with him in the low 40s. But we don't vote in primaries all on one day. There isn't a national primary day. Primaries and caucuses are sequential. So we have Iowa on the 1st of February, and then about a week later we have New Hampshire. And we know from the past that if we want to know how those primaries and caucuses are going to vote, we look at the state polling from those states. And the state polling from those states indicates that Donald Trump is not anywhere and near as a strong a position in those states as he is nationally. And historically speaking, those two states have been fairly predictive of what eventually happens in the primary. So that's why we're looking at the state polling, and the state polling doesn't paint nearly as rosy a picture for Trump.
We're taking a look at the latest in national politics with Harry Enten from 538. And Harry, you recently sat down with On the Media to give listeners a lesson about how to read the polls, how to make the most of the polls heading into 2016. What are some of the top pieces of information you want to share?
Sure. So I think one of them is what I basically just shared, which was we pay attention in primaries to the state polls, state by state, than the national primary polls. That's key. And we should also keep in mind that the state polls at this point, while they may be more predictive of the outcomes in Iowa and New Hampshire, they're still not all that predictive. There's a wide margin of error. So remember, at this point, John Edwards and John Kerry in the 2004 Iowa caucus polling were third and fourth, and they ended up being a clear first and second when the voting actually occurred. So I think that's one thing. I think the other things that you would also want to keep in mind as we're looking at the primary specifically is remember that the turnout for these primaries are going to be very, very low, especially for the Iowa caucus. So we want to really have a good idea when we're looking at the polls that we're looking at what we call likely voters. And specifically, if we can get really in-depth, know that these people have a history of voting in the primaries and caucuses. So something called list samples, which are basically we can look and say, hey, these people actually have voted in the past. And then the other thing, as we look kind of more towards the general election, is to keep in mind that the general election polls at this point are not all that predictive. In fact, not really predictive at all. We really want to wait until after the primary season and then really until after the national conventions to look at those. And if someone has a clear 4 or 5 point lead after the national conventions, then they're probably going to win the general election.
And do we want to check out who it is that is conducting the poll? Does that matter?
Sure. I mean, obviously, you know, if you hear that a poll has been done by an organization that you've heard of, say, you know, ABC or NBC or CBS, then those polls are probably going to be more reputable than the polls that are done by organizations you have never heard of, because good polls cost a lot of money, and places that you probably haven't heard of don't have that type of money to spend on the good polling. So we want to look at those polls that are by organizations that we generally know, and those are generally done by what are called live interviewers, so that someone actually has to dial you up and you talk with someone on the phone, and they can call cell phones, and there's pretty good chance that everybody in the population has an equal chance of being able to participate in those polls versus polls that may have been done over the internet, which participants in those tend to voluntarily sign up, so they're not exactly a random sample. And those polls, at least in primaries, haven't really been tested, so we want to be a little wary of reading too much into those numbers.
So as a guy who studies polls, who's into the statistics, what are you particularly excited about when we get closer to Iowa?
I think the real thing that I'm going to be excited about is to see if there's any candidate that kind of seems like he has or she has momentum. Because we know in primary polls that momentum is a real thing. You know, I'm generally kind of worried about reading too much into a trend line in which one or two polls may be outliers. But what we saw in 2012 was Rick Santorum, for instance, really rising at the last minute. Or if you look back to 2008 on the Republican side, John McCain rising at the last minute heading into New Hampshire. So we want to see if there are any candidates that have any momentum going into Iowa and New Hampshire, especially, where right now there's Trump, who is leading, but has kind of been stuck in the mid-20s, and there's been some question about whether one of his opponents will be able to coalesce the Donald Trump opposition vote, and we'll see if one of those candidates has momentum. So I'm looking for one candidate who really has momentum heading into the first two contests.
Well, right now we're down one campaign. On Monday, Lindsey Graham dropped out of the race, and I guess you could look at it either way. One is, you know, why did he stay in this long? And the other, why did he drop out this close to Iowa?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this was a case where Lindsey Graham was really going nowhere. He never really got above 1% in any of the early states, even in South Carolina, where he's from. His net favorable rating among Republican voters was really bad. It was negative, which you really rarely see a Republican having a negative net favorability rating among Republicans. So I think he recognized that he had no chance. But there are a few reasons why he dropped out. One was because I think he recognized he had no chance. It was the last day for him to not appear on the South Carolina ballot. I don't think he wanted to be embarrassed in his own home state. And I think the other thing, which is key, is that even though he wasn't doing so well in the polls, he was holding up some establishment support from the party actors, his fellow senators, who didn't really want to embarrass him by endorsing another candidate. And so now he's able to free them up to potentially endorse someone, say, like Marco Rubio.
So moving on to the Congress, to the spending bill, President Obama did sign that spending bill this past weekend, and it funds the government through the end of September 2016. And that, as you know, is just a bit over a month before that 2016 presidential election. So do you think there could be any end-of-the-road drama there right before the big election day?
Well, I think it almost depends on whether people want there to be drama. You know, if there needs to be some sort of, let's say Republicans were trailing big time heading into Election Day 2016 or a month or two before, then maybe there would be this sort of urge to say, look, nothing else is working for us, so let's try something new. Let's try maybe shut down the government. Let's try and, you know, shake up the globe a little bit, the snow globe up a little bit. But if the Republicans, for instance, are leading or it's a tight race, I don't think any side really wants to risk looking bad to the American public. So, you know, we avoided the shutdown this year. We have a new speaker in place in Paul Ryan, who supposedly has a pretty decent relationship with Harry Reid. Now, obviously, in this day and age of polarized Washington, who can really say who has a good relationship with the other side? But they supposedly have a pretty good relationship. I would find it highly doubtful that either side would be willing to shut down the government right before a presidential election, because usually the side that's deemed to be responsible for the shutdown usually suffers in the polls.
Harry, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time to talk the latest in national politics. A lot of people have time off over the next couple of weeks, whether it's for the holidays or maybe to get rid of some vacation before the end of the year. Our next guest says a great way to use that time off is to go for a hike. Yes, even in the winter. And in Wisconsin, we're lucky enough to have a national treasure in our backyard in the Ice Age National Scenic Trail. It's a 1,000-mile footpath across the state.
Rob Zimmer joins us now to talk about what's new on the Ice Age Trail in 2016 and to talk about the joys of winter hiking. He's a nature and garden writer. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Doing well. And, you know, most times around the holidays, you don't think about getting out there, lacing up your boots and getting out there. But, you know, this mild winter makes us think hiking a lot more. Like we just mentioned, the Ice Age Trail is huge, 1,000 miles. Where should we start, or where can we start if we want to start exploring it?
It's a great question. There's lots of great places you can go to explore the trail. It's actually about 1,200 miles altogether right now, so it's even longer. Lots of great places to access it. A lot of the state parks in the eastern and central part of the state have access points. Lots of great maps available. If you go to iceagetrail.org, you can plan your whole trip right there.
So it's interesting because you said it's more like 1,200 miles now. I'm guessing that means that they're still adding to the trail.
Yep, there's still segments that are being completed. There's, I believe there's about 11, maybe about 600 miles that are completely done, about 500 miles of things like interconnecting routes, access points, things like that. So it comes up to about 1,200 miles.
So the Ice Age Trail actually goes through some I don't want to say urban areas, but definitely, you know, through some towns. I know it runs along the river in Baraboo. So it's not just, you know, outdoorsy kind of scenery. There's all kinds of scenery. But as far as getting out in nature, what kind of scenery does the Ice Age Trail offer?
It's got a little bit of everything. And you are right. It does go through some communities, too, because that's one of their missions, to interconnect people and communities in nature, so it kind of covers all of it. But for the nature, you can see just about anything, and there's a lot of amazing places. I personally like the Point Beach State Park area over in Manitowoc County, just the forest there, the hemlocks and the cedars and the different kinds of wildlife you see in there. It's just amazing. It's so beautiful. And then in that same section, you're going right along the Lake Michigan dunes there at Point Beach State Park and places like that. So just about anything you want to see. There are sections that go through huge prairies. There are sections that go, you know, along waterways in the Waupaca area, goes along the beautiful, you know, the rivers there, the clear crystal rivers there, and lots of beautiful places.
So you mentioned wildlife. What's the variety that we might be able to see? Obviously, there's no guarantee that they'll be sitting there posing for us when we hit the trail. But what kind of birds and mammals might we come across?
Along the trail, you could see just about anything. I mean, in some sections of the trail, you could realistically see wolves or black bears, porcupines. I've seen mink and ruffed grouse and wild turkeys and white-tailed deer, foxes, I mean, all sorts of wildlife. And then, you know, in the deep woods areas, you can find salamanders and frogs and different things like that also.
And I have to say, seeing a porcupine in the wild is on my bucket list, so I guess I better get out there and try to find one. So we're talking...
Look up.
We're talking 1,200 miles of trail. What's kind of the range of difficulty of different parts of the Ice Age Trail?
It's primarily a footpath, so it's designated for foot travel, not like biking and things like that, although there are many areas where you can bike, because a lot of the trail, it coincides with state bike trails and things like that, or like you said, into communities. But a lot of the sections, it ranges from a narrow, narrow, rugged path that you can barely even identify. You know, you follow the white flag, or the yellow flag, I should say. But it varies in difficulty from actually really difficult to very simple and almost flat, paved in some areas.
And those maps that you refer to that are available, do those indicate kind of, you know, how strenuous different stretches are?
Yep. On the website, theiceagetrail.org, you can find maps for basically for the entire trail, and it will identify what sections are wet, and the like you said, the levels. You can find that out there.
We're talking with Rob Zimmer. He's a nature and garden writer, and we were talking about the Ice Age Scenic Trail, National Ice Age Scenic Trail. It's a 1,200-mile footpath across the state, and we are talking about the wonders of the trail and why it's a good idea to get out hiking at this time of year. So are there good day hikes, Rob, that you would suggest if someone just wants to go out for maybe, you know, a couple hours over the holidays? What are some different segments in different parts of the state that might be good to look at?
Oh, there's lots of them. Like I mentioned, Manitowoc County, if you're in the eastern part of the state, Manitowoc County at Through Point Peach there. I'm in the Kewaunee area. There's the whole Kewaunee River Trail there. It goes up through Pottawatomie State Park and Sturgeon Bay. Then it kind of goes down through the Kettle Moraine. So if you're in the Sheboygan, Fond du Lac area, there's a segment there, the Parnell segment, that goes through, you know, around the Parnell Tower area in the Kettle Moraine, through the Greenbush Kettles. Then it keeps going south, you know, down into Waukesha County, down that way. Then it kind of turns and comes back up. Devil's Lake State Park is a popular area there. The trail kind of goes through there. The Waupaca County area, Hartman Creek State Park, Emmons Creek State Wildlife Area, those are beautiful areas right through there. Washera County has the Mekan River area. And then down in Madison, you know, down in Day County, they have Table Bluff and some other areas down there. So lots of different places. No matter where you are, you're not far from an access point to the trail.
One of the things that I really like about the Ice Age Trail is that, as you said, they're continually developing the trail and developing in the best possible sense, making it more accessible so people can get there. And so much of that is done by volunteers. And I think that's just a great thing to point out.
Yes, it is. Just about the entire trail has been put together by volunteers. And the other thing the volunteers do is a lot of the activities, and there's a lot of different family-friendly activities. One of my big goals as a nature writer is to get families and kids out into nature, and there's so many different activities out there that these volunteers and these chapter groups have put together to help get people out there and get exploring.
And, you know, so, Rob, it is winter, officially, at least on the calendar. It's not looking very wintry, but it is a little on the chilly side, a little on the wet side. And I'm assuming at some point it'll actually feel like a Wisconsin winter. Why do you think winter hiking is worth going out in the cold?
Oh, it's beautiful. You can, you know, whether or not there's snow, you can find amazing things. Like today I was out hiking and I found frogs, like lots of them. So you can always find something. And I always encourage people, especially in the winter, to look closer. You know, even if there's no snow, look at the trees, because you have lichens and mosses and mushrooms and fungi growing all over. And listen to the birds or lack of birds even, because sometimes the lack of sound is just as thrilling, you know, when you just hear nothing. But there's so much beauty out there, even in the winter. You know, even as far as investigating the snow crystals, there's little kits you can buy to to pick up little snow crystals and identify, you know, what kind of precipitation that is.
And it's certainly easier to see raptors because there are no leaves on the trees, and so they're much more easy to spot.
Right, and you can see a lot of different ones from along different sections of the trail. You know, where it goes through open country, you can see red-tailed hawks and short-eared owls and even snowy owls in some places. And in the woods, you can see great horned owls and barred owls and different hawks and things like that in the woods, too. So lots of different birds of prey you can see in the winter.
So as we finish up, Rob, what advice do you have for listeners who have never even thought about hiking in the winter and are kind of wondering, you know, what they need, maybe what they need as far as clothing and footwear to get out there and enjoy the winter outdoors?
Yep. Obviously, you know, the common things are dress in layers, wear, depending on the weather, wear certain clothing that's not going to get too hot or too cool, where you can take stuff off. If it's really deep snow, obviously some good hiking boots or good winter boots are good. If you're bringing kids out, obviously you want to prepare them. So the hat, gloves, scarf, mittens, everything right there. So just, so they don't get frostbite or anything like that. But you also don't want them to get too hot because mm-hmm. you're going to get really hot as you're out hiking in the winter. You start to sweat and that kind of actually cools you off. So just your typical whatever you wear out sledding or ice skating, things like that.
Well, Rob, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Rob Zimmer, nature and garden writer. He was with us to talk about the Ice Age National Scenic Trail and the joys of winter hiking.
There's a bill circulating in the state legislature that would allow property owners to excavate ancient Native American burial mounds.
State Senator Chris Kapinga introduced the bill, which could settle a long legal battle over protected status of effigy mounds located in Blooming Grove.
The Ho-Chunk Nation and the companies Wingerstone and Ready Mix are at odds over a 3-acre plot of land which is surrounded by quarry. Winger wants to mine the area while the Ho-Chunk Nation wants to preserve it.
State Senator Chris Kapinga and officials from Wingerstone did not respond to our interview requests.
Joining us now is Wilfred Cleveland, president of the Ho-Chunk Nation. President Cleveland, welcome to Central Time.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you.
Well, these mounds are part of the Ward Mound Group. What do they mean to the Ho-Chunk Nation?
Well, these mounds and other mounds within the state are burial mounds, and they are sacred to us as any other, like in 1986 when this Burial Site Preservation Act came in and was signed by then Governor Tommy Thompson. And at that time, it was understood that they were sacred to the Native Americans, not only the Ho-Chunks, but other tribes within the state. And it's still so today.
And a lot of people and religions have strong beliefs about the burial places of the dead. What do the Ho-Chunk believe?
Like I was saying, these are sacred. I mean, like they have configurations on them. And I, just for a clarification purpose, I would look at that as a headstone on someone's grave. And that's what these markers, and there's multiple graves that are done in this fashion, not only one person. But so they are sacred. I mean, like, for instance, with a headstone, how they are there to mark where the individual was laid to rest until who knows when, like forever. And that was the same inclination that our elders had in putting up these figures, configurations that we thought were important to us then, and they still are today. These configurations are important.
Now, the area surrounding these mounds had been excavated for years until the year 1990, when that area was officially cataloged as a burial site. What led to that area being classified as a burial site?
Well, the mounds that are there are burial mounds, and that's the reason why they've been cataloged as such.
Now, the State Historical Society is involved in this, too. How did they determine whether or not these mounds are the home of human remains?
These mounds, those that are like archaeologists and type, know that there's different movement or different layers of soil that are there. So there's There's different even soil from other places that were bought in to make these mounds. So it's not all you can see. There was a change in the soil, like how it's been moved. Like it's not all layered. You know, all the layers of earth are not the same.
So you're saying, looking at the way that the soil beneath has been moved, it indicates that this would have been intentional burial practice.
Correct.
Over the years, people have used radar and other methods to try to be certain about whether there are human remains beneath the surface of these mounds, and some involved in this say that the results haven't been clear. Why not?
Well, I guess from what I understand, in speaking with archaeologists, there isn't these ground penetrating radar technology that they have. It doesn't show like the let's say the bones of a person being there, but they know that this technology can detect where this movement and this change of the soil is, these layers.
We're talking right now with Ho-Chunk Nation President Wilfred Cleveland, talking about proposed legislation that would allow property owners to excavate ancient Native American burial mounds. And you have these companies saying maybe to them the looking at the soil and the analysis there is not enough. They would like to actually see the human remains there. So is that the only way, do you think, to determine whether or not there are human remains in the mounds?
Well, I guess for us as Native Americans and trying to get this understood is that the only way that these they could be detected or they would know would be the actual digging of these mounds, and that's what we're trying to protect people from being able to physically dig into the mound to see what's there. And let's say they go 6 inches, they don't find nothing, then they'll go 6 feet to find something. By that time, the sacredness has been touched, and we don't want that. We don't want those kinds of. I mean, like we know that the way that the burials were in the past, and the way that with technology today, all that they have, like. They have vaults that they use for burial purposes, and those kinds of things weren't done. The idea was similar, I guess, parallel to what the Bible says, where your body would be back ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and that's the same thing. We know that that's going to happen way back in those years. That this is what happens with the body as it decomposes in the ground. And there is not going to be any bones there to say, like, what this legislation that Senator Kapingas has, that it's not going to be showing. There's not going to be showing no bones there. So, I mean, there's even, like, people don't seem to understand that this is what we're trying to protect, our burial sites.
So you're saying even with the excavation, there wouldn't be proof, even if there were human remains, too much time has passed.
And that's what they're saying, that, well, since there ain't no bones there, then there ain't no grave, which doesn't make sense, because you and I know that if it's a burial site such as that, there's not going to be any bones if they're like thousands of years old.
Now, right now, this law is centering around the site near Blooming Grove, but if this law were passed, what would it mean for effigy mounds around the entire state of Wisconsin?
I guess that's the way that we're looking at it. We're looking at all the burial sites that we have. We know that, like, over the years, like, there has been so many mounds have been destroyed, and we're trying to prevent any more from being destroyed, so we're opposing this legislation that will make it possible for Well, not only for ours, but like early pioneer settlers that have had graves, they would be also destroyed too. So it's not only us, you know, that this law would protect if it's if we defeat it.
You're trying to defeat the law. What tactics are you using? What are you trying to achieve?
What are we trying to achieve?
Right, in blocking
the
law.
We're trying to keep the law that was in place, what they put in place in 1986, I believe. We're trying to, because that's the law that they're trying to change. They're saying they're amending this law to make it easier for people to desecrate our burial mounds.
And do you have non-Native allies working with you on blocking this law?
Well, we have a number of people that are interested in what's the outcome of this. Yes, not only Native American, but there are other religious leaders, organizations, and the general public that are kind of keeping an eye on this legislation.
Now, if this law were to be passed, what type of action would the Ho-Chunk Nation take to try to continue fighting to preserve the mounds?
I really can't say it right now. I really don't want to discuss the because we have a court case. I don't want to kind of discuss that too much.
Well, we leave it there. President Cleveland, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Ho-Chunk Nation President Wilfred Cleveland talking about proposed legislation that would allow property owners to excavate Native American burial mounds.
State Senator Chris Kepping introduced the bill. He was not available for an interview, nor were the companies Wingerstone and Ready Mix. Coming up, how do you feel about the fact that we're going to have a brown Christmas this year? Are you upset that we haven't had more winter weather so far this season, or are you happy to have the milder weather? Will this brown Christmas affect your travel plans? Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Clear a path and lift a spade of snow.
Snow. To see a great big man entirely made of snow.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Yesterday was the first official day of winter, but we haven't had much snow, and it's been raining, at least here in southern Wisconsin this week. With Christmas on Friday, that means we're probably going to have a brown Christmas.
It's been a topic of conversation around the office. How do we feel about this brown Christmas, this El Nino Christmas? And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'd love to hear your thoughts about not only a brown holiday season, but maybe the prospect of a mostly brown winter, too. Do you care that we've had such a mild winter so far? Do you like this taste of maybe what it's like to be in a state a little farther south? And is the winter weather, or lack of same, how is it affecting your travel plans? Do you miss the snow? Call in right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Well, I'll say that most of my family is in the Chicago area, and there we had a really bad stretch there where we could not get down for Christmas Eve because mostly of icy conditions, not so much snow, but really icy road conditions. And so we missed our family Christmas Eve a few years in a row, and that was really a bummer. So I'm actually excited that the travel will be easier, safer, more reliable with the brown. The scenery will definitely not be as festive, but you know, I think it's okay, at least for tomorrow.
We did have the polar vortex. I think it was 2 years ago, so everybody still remembers that, is maybe a little scarred from that. To some people, this may be a welcome relief. To other people, it's just not a Wisconsin winter when there is no snow on the ground. In fact, I keep thinking, maybe this is what it feels like to live in the Pacific Northwest
with
this rain and the damp and the fog.
I have to say, one of the things I've heard from so many people is that any kind of holiday shopping, holiday preparations totally snuck up on people. people because it didn't feel like it. You know, we had here in Madison, we had a week where there were, you know, 60 plus degree days, and it just does not feel like you should be getting out and doing holiday shopping when you're wearing, you know, a short sleeve t-shirt outside.
Right. And a lot of people, they love the winter sports. They like to get their skiing in. I have a pair of cross-country skis sitting in the garage that we actually have yet to break in. They're used. Someone else has used them, but I haven't yet because, you know, there's no snow, and last winter we just didn't get around to it. But it changes things.
It really does. And we do have a caller, Roger in Washburn County, would like to join in. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I was just good. You were talking about your brown Christmas. Well, come up here.
Are you getting some snow up there?
Oh, yes. It's been snowing for about the last 4 or 5 hours.
And we've got
probably 3 to 4 inches of really heavy, wet snow, but it looks beautiful. The trees are all white, and it's definitely a white Christmas up here. Just wanted to call it.
Well, no, that's good. And you said heavy, wet snow. Does it look like it's going to actually stick around, or is it going to be slushy?
No, it's sticking around. In fact, I had to plow out. Our driveway is about 3/10 of a mile long, so I went and plowed that out. But it's wet and heavy, but it's sure pretty.
That's fantastic. I actually wish I could go up to Washburn and check it out. I almost feel like I've forgotten what snow in winter is like. Mm-hmm. There's just so much mud. Well, thanks so much, Roger. We're going to move on next to Alex joining us in Eau Claire. Alex, hi.
Hey there. How's it going?
Good, thanks.
I want to say that this is my first, I'm 25 years old. This is my first time having this muddy, wet Christmas ever, and I'm pretty disappointed, mostly because I can't go snowboarding because there's no snow on any of the slopes.
Well, I've been curious about this. Does this mean, and I'm not a person who goes downhill skiing where they manufacture the snow, is it just too warm to do that too?
I looked up some places in Wausau last night, and like 3 runs are open because they manufacture the snow, but most of them are closed. So I won't even go. It's not worth it for me.
Yeah, so that's got to be cutting into some of the economics too, the winter sports scene. Well, Alex, thanks a lot for that. Yeah, you could also call it a muddy Christmas, brown or muddy, except in up north, Washburn.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. When you look out the window, does it feel like Christmas, New Year's is right around the corner, or does it feel more like maybe Easter? Kind of muddy, you know, there's not a lot going on out there. We'd love to have you join in. 800-642-1234. Well, Veronica, you said that you have cross-country skis that you've been dying to break in. We bought some skis a couple of years ago, and I think we've used them all of twice because there was a winter where it was either way too cold and icy, or it was too warm and there was no snow.
You kind of have to hit that sweet spot. Right. I like it when it's sort of almost 30 or so and snowy. Mm-hmm. That's my ideal.
I kind of feel sorry for the kids that are off school that might want to be getting out and playing in the snow. I actually feel sorry for the parents who have the kids at home who would rather be outside. So hopefully maybe some of that snow in Washburn will make it down.
And we're going to go back to the phones at 800-642-1234. If you are in one of those areas getting a little bit of snow right now, tell us about it. Are you happy about it? If you're not, if you're seeing more of the mud Christmas that Alex described, what do you think about that? Is it getting in the way of your holiday cheer or not? And we're going to go next to Carl in Madison. Carl, hi.
Yes, hello. It affects us as people wandering around and thinking about, you know, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. But on a deeper level, the issues of the ways in which El Nino and climate change in general and the ways that we have warmed the atmosphere and the leaders meeting in Paris attempting to right some of these wrongs so that our kids will have some white Christmases in the future is what's on my mind. And I don't say that just to be a downer at the holidays, but to encourage people to engage in those discussions with their politicians through 350 Madison and other organizations that are taking this issue seriously so that our kids can enjoy white Christmases in the future.
Well, Carl, I'm sure that's on a lot of minds. Thank you.
And let's go back to the phones, and Jim in Arcadia is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'd just like to say I'm pro no snow. we've had the snow. We'll have it again. And what would we all be doing if there was 2 foot of snow on the ground and it was 20 below zero?
All right. Well, Jim is on the record as pro no snow. Let's go back to the phones and Donald in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, Donald.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Doing well. How about yourself?
All right, fine. Say, I moved here from Lake Tahoe, where I'm used to 300 inches of snow a year, and I've been in the Ironwood area for about 10 years now. I do a lot of snowmobiling, and this year, I guess my Christmas present is not going to arrive because I won't be buying a new snowmobile the way it looks. What can I say?
I have to ask
you.
Money
and shaving, though.
Donald, were you joking about 300 inches?
No. Lake Tahoe.
For real.
Fantastic for snow. We lived on the west shore where we just got dumped on year after year. And finally, with El Nino, they're getting more snow than they can handle right now because the last 3-4 years, it's been terrible up there. Last year, they didn't even open half the ski hills in the Lake Tahoe area because lack of snow.
Interesting, these fluctuations, and also just 300 inches of snow.
Right.
I can't quite get my brain around it. But Donald, thanks a lot for calling.
And let's wrap up with Stacy in Green Bay. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I don't mind that we're having a green or brown Christmas. we've had quite a bit of snow in years past, and this has happened before. I've driven to Michigan in the early 2000s, and it was raining on Christmas Eve, but then it snowed the next day. But and also, as far as the economics, this is something farmers deal with every year as far as, you know, the downturn for, you know, kind of the people that depend on the snowmobilers and the ski hills and things like that. And it's just one of those things that you kind of have to deal with, and, you know, next year will probably be better, so...
Well, just hang tight. Is that what you're saying, Stacey?
Yes, and kind of enjoy this. We could get hit pretty bad in January and February. We've still got quite a bit of winter to go yet. So,
Stacey, thanks for that, and thanks so much for all your calls and comments. And you can continue this conversation on the Central Time Facebook page.
Sleigh bells in the snow.
Well, the new movie hasn't been out for very long, but it seems like Star Wars fever is hitting hard.
I was at the store last night, and of course there were rows and rows of Star Wars toys for kids, but of course they were sold out of all the really good lightsabers already.
Well, we won't spoil anything for you if you haven't seen the new Star Wars yet, but Yoda speak is trending on Twitter. The idea, people translate their favorite lines into Yoda. To refresh your memory, Yoda talks like this.
Away with your weapon. I mean you no harm. I am wondering, why are you here?
I'm looking for someone.
Looking? Found someone you have, I would say.
And that's a little bit of the very first meeting of Luke and Yoda when Yoda's acting a little goofy, but you get the idea. So here's a little bit of what people are sharing on Twitter. Crying in baseball. There is none.
Believe it is not butter, I cannot.
The truth you want? Handle the truth, you cannot.
Eat this bacon, you must.
And here's a favorite one if you're up on song lyrics today. When with you I am, my face I cannot feel, but love and I do.
So you can share your favorite, should we say, Yodified quotes on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Central Time, this is on Wisconsin Public Radio.